Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. My next guest is actor Willem Dafoe. In his latest film, At Eternity's Gate, he plays Vincent van Gogh in the last years of his life. Van Gogh is painting quickly and feverishly at the time, churning out art that only after his death will be revered. But he's also suffering from seizures and mental illness. Let's listen to a clip from the trailer.
I think of myself as an exile.
You're Vincent.
Yes,
sales brother. I'm Paul Gauguin.
We have to start a revolution, do you understand?
The film not only takes a close look at Van Gogh's life, but at his work. And it is directed by Julian Schnabel, a painter in his own right. Willem Dafoe, welcome to All of It.
Thanks.
So what did you know about Vincent van Gogh going into this?
Probably what most people knew. Some misinformation. Mm-hmm. I knew his paintings, certainly. I probably didn't have a special way to look at them or appreciate them. I had read his letters years ago, and I was really struck by them. But even then, I didn't quite know how to look at the paintings.
They're really great to experience en masse, like if you go to the museum in Amsterdam.
I've been there many times, and in fact, there was a theater in Amsterdam called the Mikkeri, and they were very good at bringing foreign groups in. And I went there a lot with the Wooster Group, and I would always go to the Van Gogh Museum.
As you began to do research for this role, what were you trying to seek out? What did you try to figure out?
I think I didn't ask myself that. I had a concrete thing that I was learning to paint, because that was very essential, because in order to do the film, yes, I knew it was going to be about painting, but I didn't know how much. But I had this practical thing that there were a lot of scenes where I painted. And no one else was going to paint them. No stunt painters. So I know Julian for a long time, and I've been with him in the studio, and I know how he works, and I've been around him. I've done little small roles in his films. So he makes a film like he paints, and I'm used to being in the studio with him, and he's painted me. So I knew some things, but he really gave me a crash course in painting, basically, which was wonderful because it really changed how I see things, and that really became the key to, that became the way in, because then all the things that are said in the letters and also some of the scenes that were set up, I started to have a concrete relationship to them.
We're going to talk about the back half of that answer, but the first half, he makes a film like he paints, Julian Schnabel. What does that mean?
It's just, intuitive, clear, have strong ideas, has strong strategies, but also is able to be flexible, open, he's not, I relate to the fact that he's not an interpreter. He's not a guy that has an idea and then he just executes using film language. He's really, he goes to find out something that he doesn't know. Now, he starts out in this case with having a very strong identification and has strong feelings about Van Gogh as a painter. Being a painter himself and having Van Gogh be a strong figure in his life. So he starts there, but I think, and he had very strong ideas about certain things, but there was also some room to invite you to collaborate and invite the weather being in Arles and the other locations in France and many things to send us on our way.
What was something you two collaborated on that we can see in the film?
Also, while formally I never had anything to do with the text, the actual screenplay, I remember when he was working with Jean-Claude Carrière on the screenplay, and he wasn't sure yet that he was going to do the movie, he said, take a look at the Naifa White Smith book, A Life, which is a big biography on Van Gogh. Very good, balanced. You know, he quotes the letters a lot. It has some, it posits some theories. It's a good read. I really enjoyed it. He said, read that and just lift out anything that you like from the letters or any events or any details. And I read it, kind of read it for him. And at this point, I'm not even involved in the project. I'm doing it for my own pleasure and for the possibility that I might be involved. And I made all these notes and I sent it to him. And some of that found its way into the screenplay. So that was a strange kind of collaboration. And it's like anything. I become his creature and I become an extension of him. So whether it's Benoit Delhomme, the DP, or the costumer, we all kind of became the same person. So what we collaborated on is hard to say. It's hard to say, but I felt very close to him. And I, as I said, I kind of, the painting was the bonding thing, because he's teaching me something and I'm trying to see how he sees and then imagine then how Van Gogh sees, which was a radical thing. And it's very concrete. It's not abstract at all. He taught me how to make marks. He taught me how to paint light. He taught me how to see things as I see them, not how I thought I saw them. Mm-hmm. Always, which is a big lesson about, you know, the split between what's there and what you see, what's visible and what's invisible, what comes off something, mm-hmm. and what is apparent to the light. All those things are in the mix. So it's a very rich place to start from.
We're speaking with Willem Dafoe about his new film, At Eternity's Gate, which is about the life of Vincent van Gogh. And there's this great scene in the movie where Gauguin is telling Vincent van Gogh, you put too much paint on your paintings. It's a mess. You can't put so much paint. Why do you think Van Gogh used so much paint?
I don't know. I know he liked
to
paint.
Well, why did you, as Van Gogh, use so much paint? How about
that? because it was in the screenplay. I don't know. I never made that choice, but that was the style that I was I was painting in. Mm-hmm. And you could see it. You could see it. I mean, we're not making, you know, because he was living with a lot of his paintings and he was very prolific toward the end of his life. He was living with his paintings. So just for set dressing, never mind what I was actually painting or partially painting in the scenes, we made lots of copies. We made lots of copies. There was a whole workshop of people making copies. And then, of course, Julian would touch them up if they were mm-hmm. featured, give them life. And that's what you could see, that thickness, that heaviness. That I don't know whether that's quoted or invented, but it was interesting to have that dialogue between Gauguin, Van Gogh. Probably the most interesting to me was where Van Gogh says, I don't invent the picture. I see it in nature, and I just have to free it. That means volumes to me, as opposed to Gauguin, who said, you gotta use your imagination to, you know, paint from memory. You're a sucker to be, you're bound by painting from models. And it's something I sort of relate to as an actor. I mean, I take Van Gogh's side on this. It's nice to work with a model, and then it frees you in, you can go deeper somehow. It's like when you copy something, some people think, well, that's not very creative. The truth is, it frees up a certain part of your mind for the quality of how you enter into that activity of making the reproduction. And you end up with something that's not really a copy. That's just the jumping off point. In the same way that Van Gogh would talk about great painting is not painting things as they are, but as you see it. He wanted to... It's like in the film, you see me paint the shoes. You see the accumulation of marks. And while the color's not really correct and it's not a good reproduction or it's not a good likeness necessarily, it does capture the shoes. And in those moments, that really becomes a key in a different way of seeing. And for me, That was thrilling. And hopefully, this film is very experiential. So you're with Van Gogh. You're in his head. You're walking when he's walking. You're like a little bird on his shoulder. You're with him. So obviously, when he's doing that painting, hopefully you have that same experience.
It's interesting you said about the shoes. You experience them, and I thought maybe sort of the thickness of the painting is like you feel them.
Julian talks beautifully about you know, a great painting. It welcomes you into its presentness. And that's, you know, like those, let's say, his paintings, you feel the swirl of things. You feel the rise and fall of things. You feel you're able to enter into things as they are. But you're looking at something that was created centuries ago, but it's still living. And that's the beauty of art.
In the film, something I really enjoyed was his relationships, knowing more about his relationships with Gauguin, with Theo. And I don't know if it's meant to be a funny scene. I apologize if I took it. When Gauguin and Vincent are talking about other painters.
Oh, yes. It's funny. It's funny.
Gauguin's like, Monet.
Yeah. He says, oh, come on. He's pretty good. Yeah. It's like changing baseball cards or something. There's something very everyday about it.
Yeah, something sort of like quotidian, but also sort of light, because we always think of Van Gogh as such a heavy story.
And he struggled, but I think one thing that when we were making this movie, I thought as much about his joy and those ecstatic states, and some of his sickness was his inability to reconcile these ecstatic states and his love for painting and his love for nature and him contacting God through nature. How does he reconcile that with his social awkwardness, the fact that he doesn't have, you know, he's solitary, he's isolated, he doesn't have any sentimental relationships really to speak of. He's awkward. He repels people. That was part of the story, but given the events that we that are in the film, I don't think we lean too much on. I didn't enter it by thinking about his sickness.
Mm-hmm. I also just love that we got to see his relationships, that people loved him.
Yes. Oh, his brother was his brother. That was, it's beautiful. It's moving. I mean, when I see a movie, sometimes the thing that moves me more than anything else is when people are kind to each other. Simple as that. And I think about it even now. And the figure of Theo, he's, that's real love. That's real love. Love for nothing, you know? I mean, love for love. It's a free love.
We're talking to Willem Dafoe about the new film, At Eternity's Gate, which is about the life and the work of Vincent van Gogh. You said you filmed it in France, right?
Oh, absolutely. It was the only place, you know, I joke. I say this couldn't be filmed in Burbank. It certainly could.
Better not.
No, we filmed.
That would be wrong.
Not only did we film it in France, we filmed it basically where he was for the events that we're dealing with. In Arles, in Saint-Rémy, in Auvers-sur-Oise. Anybody that speaks French, forgive my accent. I've worked on it for the movie, but it's gotten away from me. And then, of course, Paris. And it was beautiful because some places you could actually see the landscapes are still recognizable. Certain things are gone. The famous yellow house is no longer there. But, you know, when the land does have a knowledge. It's the same light. It's the same skies. It's in some cases, it's the same fields and the same trees. And that connects you. It slaps you around and makes you serious about what you're doing and connects you to what is there, and that is he's still there.
Mm-hmm. Especially the light.
Yes. The light, you know, we shot, I mean, part of the joke is in the movie he says, you know, I'm sick of the grayness of Paris. I need a new light. I want to, you know, And Gauguin says, go south. And he does go south, but it's the winter time. And I'm telling you, Arles in November, December is tough.
Pretty gray.
It's gray and also really cold. So, I didn't have to think about the suffering of Vincent van Gogh because I was suffering.
When you think about Vincent van Gogh, and I think what most people think about it, there's part of the mythology, although it's true, the mythology of him having cut off his ear. Mm-hmm. When you approach that, I'm curious just what you thought about how are we going to do this so that it isn't, I don't know, sort of like the gift shop postcard version of it.
Well, we don't deal with it sort of. I mean, we acknowledge it, but you don't see that happen.
He answers the questions very matter-of-factly.
Yes.
About why he did it.
Yes. And also there's lots of questions. You know, he called it a trifle. He didn't think it was a big deal. And there's some debate, actually, to how much ear was cut off. Was it a little lobe? Was it the whole thing? Mm-hmm. We don't know this. But in our film, the film is dealing with painting. The film is dealing with being an artist. The film is dealing with an artist's relationship to society. It's not about explaining away certain events in his life.
So it's not in terms of, and it isn't a biopic, and this happened, and then this happened, and
that led
there.
And this is why.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is often biographies of films of famous figures, particularly if they're artists or dancers mm-hmm. or something, the actor learns how to do the things, but that's never the focus. It's always the psychological makeup that made them the great, you know, dancer, the great mm-hmm. singer. And you may see swatches of things, but it's never about really what they did. Van Gogh said, I am my paintings. Well, the concentration of this movie is it's a visual treatment. It's a first-person treatment. It doesn't step outside and judge him or say he is one way or another. It doesn't necessarily even say he's, you know, mentally disturbed. He says certain things that you can decide whether he is or not, but it's not played out in a way that really accounts for who Vincent van Gogh is, but it does consider who he might have been and what he might have thought and how he might have approached his painting. And that's all fueled by doing certain things concretely mm-hmm. and also very much by Julian's relationship to him and, of course, mine. It all gets mixed up. But... the film is different in the fact that it's a painter is making a film about a painter, and that's significant.
Do you want to continue painting personally?
I do, but you know, it hasn't really worked out because I like to work, and my life is fairly nomadic. And when I was painting, you know, I was painting in nature, but I like to have my stuff with me. You know, you get attached to your materials and you like the practice of painting. You like the being in a studio. You like or a studio or outside, but you need some sort of regularity, I think, to keep having a cumulative, you know, to get a direction going. I don't know. That's what I felt like. So when the circumstances that allow me to be a painter disappear, I think that painter in me sort of disappears. It's similar to when you play a role, you know, mm-hmm. when the circumstances leave, slowly that character goes back to wherever it came from. You learn certain things and you don't forget it, and you learn certain lessons, and some will stay, or certain emotional things happen to you, or certain ways of thinking change, and that will stay with you, but you got to practice to keep something up. And I'm an actor. I run around. I do different things. I travel a lot.
You're here. You're
there. You know, yeah. So I think I wish I was painting. I love painting. And particularly, I loved it when Julian was, standing by my side suggesting certain strategies and certain things because I started getting his head. And I like that when I can go towards someone else's point of view and then make it my own. So there's a shift there that really opens up your mind and opens up your heart in a way that we're not usually used to doing.
I'm going to save the obvious question for the end. What does the title of the movie mean, At Eternity's Gate?
It's simply, I mean, it'll mean what you need it to mean once you watch the movie, but it's simply the title of one of his paintings, which is an older guy holding his head, you know, in his hands, bent over, looks pretty distressed.
You like this movie a lot, don't you? I can tell
I
you
do,
really
I
like
do.
It.
I had a good time making it, and I think it's beautiful, and it changed me. And it was a beautiful opportunity, because not only did he teach me how to paint, but Van Gogh made him available to me, and now it helps me appreciate him. It helps me appreciate his painting. So all those are wonderful things. And I just think it's a beautiful movie. And people, it can make them see in a new way. And that's always what you want from a movie.
The name of the film is At Eternity's Gate. Willem Dafoe, it was a pleasure to meet you.
Great, thanks.
Thanks for stopping by the studio.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Coming up next on All of It, we'll talk to the director of a new documentary called Of Sons and Fathers by Syrian filmmaker Talal Derki. Stay with us. All of It will be back after a break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. Welcome back. Syrian filmmaker Talal Derki wanted to explore the psychology of radical jihadists that had flocked to his home country during the Syrian civil war, and he didn't think he could do it from his new home in Germany. So he left his family behind in Berlin, grabbed his camera, pretended to be a jihadist sympathizer, and embedded with a family committed to the cause of al-Nusra, the Syrian arm of al-Qaeda. The resulting documentary is a searing depiction of childhood experience under the most violent circumstances. Over the course of 2.5 years, Talal lived in home Syria with a jihadist who had named his sons Osama and Ayman, after Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri. Derki filmed the boys as they grew up, and they learned from their father and became radicalized themselves. The Fathers and Sons won the World Cinema Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival and is now playing at the Museum of Moving Image in Queens. Talal Derki, welcome to All of It.
Thank you.
So I want to give a little bit of your backstory. You fled Syria when the civil war began and moved your family to Berlin. So at what point did you realize that you wanted to go back and document this story?
Yeah, I mean, we as the filmmakers like believe that it's a time where documentary, because we do also fiction, so I thought it's time for documentary, this to capture the reality of the ground in cinematic point of view, like to have the parallel cinematic vision about what's happened in Syria, because this phenomenon, it's everybody around the world start to talk, everyone talk in different way, and things going very quickly, and time that half of the Syrian people left to become refugees in the border countries and in Europe. Meanwhile, a thousand instead of terrorists, they moved to Syria to build the caliphate and to do the jihad and to live their the life of Salafist movement there, and then those who stay there, they become barred from this movement and they become like changed. So the village I filmed there, it's, well, for an example, it was Sufi. And Sufi is a moderate Islam in a way. They are believe in peace. They are believe that God is inside everyone, soul, everyone, body, and they are against violence. They are open to the all sectors. Salafist movement is famous, like it's behind Al Qaeda, behind ISIS, behind all those radical group. Those who killed the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, they are Salafist also. They believe in killing. So it's a time that the savagery, it's returned. And not only, I mean, you can see it in this Salafist movement very clear, but if you look around you, how politically countries change, how those radical extremist presidents take the authority in many countries, in Brazil, here, in Turkey, in Russia, in many places they are, and they communicate, they organize things between themselves. This is remind me like of how the political situation happened before the Second World War, and this is like kind for me a statement against the radicalism and against the extremist.
To get the access that you got, to be able to live among these people for this long period of time, you had to pretend to agree with what they believe in.
Yep, yeah.
What was that like for you?
This is the only way. It's not about like, it's not about option. This kind of film is not similar to...
What did that feel like?
It's feel like it's torturing, like, you know, like... When you think it's hurt at any, because we times grant there very slow, and I found myself because I'm doing a real time shooting, and it's not like capturing something happened in the past through interviews and this, so it's as an element it's more fiction film. The language of filming, so it's real time shooting, and it's a village where everything goes slow. Meanwhile, I have to be barred from something. I'm not only not believe, I'm against it. So I'm an artist, open minded girl, so I believe in the freedom, and I'm with the people who really fight the freedom, and. And I have to do all these things they do, like from the moment they wake up, like 4 o'clock in the morning to pray, from all the discussion, from all this, like you feel you are back on time, like you are 1,400 years ago in the desert of Saudi Arabia, living this period of time. So this is the only way to protect myself and also to be long time. It was important to be able that they will accept me, and to be able to stay there for a long time. So because this kind this kind of vision about the following the last years of those kids need to spend years. And also like with to film what I want to film, not what they want me to film.
You were, so people understand specifically, you were with a family following a father and a son specifically, and the father is devout member of al-Nusra. Now, can you explain to people the difference? He does it in the film, the difference between al-Nusra and ISIS.
Yeah, he said in his point of view that al-Nusra is the good son for al-Qaeda. Meanwhile, ISIS the bad son because he didn't obey the father, who's Al Qaeda. So the Al Nusra don't show their violence, don't show their savages, their brutal, their all those things, all these crimes they don't film. Mm-hmm. Not like ISIS. ISIS capture everything and publish it because they want to send a fearness to the people outside.
They want to terrorize the world.
Yeah, terrorize the world. Yeah. So and also like they listen to their leaders in Afghanistan, like Ayman al-Zawahiri and the others. So they obey what they want, and they organize with them. And this is why they believe they are good. He believed, but also after that, he followed other group of jihad, which more radical than Al Nusra. It's called like the guardian of the religion. Yeah. So and now they are very strong, and the main character of the film he get killed in the 17th of October this month while he was dismantling a bomb car.
This man who you followed was through this film.
Yes, the father, the main character.
Killed. Wow.
Yeah. And I learned this by video, like it was published on Facebook, and about the moment when he get killed, when the car exploded. So
wow. In the film, this man is Abu Osama. He's named his sons after Osama bin Laden, after Ayman al-Zawahiri.
Yeah.
He's really a true believer. He also is, and this is something that's very interesting part of your filmmaking, he's a devoted father.
Yes.
He loves his children very
This is what
much.
People don't use to see, because everything nobody saw for any film for about how this society looked like from inside. The only thing we used to see is the usual classic jihadist, like the one front line with a gun or with a knife and fight his enemy. So everything about fights, we don't know about social life. We don't know about brainwashing, and this was my purpose to go through to bring it to the audience, to know what's inspired Osama, what's had he seen to make him from innocent boy to a jihadist, how they brainwash him,
the little boy,
the little boy. So it's about his relation and how. Like it's his last year, it's his memory. Mm-hmm. So it's his memory, it should be the father, should be lovely father.
We're speaking with Talal Derke about his documentary of Fathers and Sons. One of the things that is a moment in the film which is very telling to me is you're documenting the young boys who are in that pre-adolescent 10, 11, 12 when they're really vulnerable and impressionable.
Yeah, he born in 2003.
And
the
they,
main character, yeah.
They, like they're, not, he, they're not going to school.
The first,
they're told
yes,
not to go to school.
Yes.
They are separated from children who are getting education so that they can get a jihadi education.
And you see them like throwing stones on the girls' school, on the girls on the school. Big stones, like it can mm-hmm. kill. So he want to be exactly a copy of his father,
the little boy.
Yeah, so the moment when he see from the first scene in the with them that he slide the bird because he want to do like his father, how he slide his enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So he slides from the neck and so
yeah, early on in the film the little boy kills a bird.
Yeah.
And there's a sort of a subtle celebration that he had it in him to kill the bird.
Yeah, he imitated because he said, "I want to do like what you did to that guy, father." So he want to be a jihadist because his father is his idol, and he don't know what's going outside the world. He don't have other memories. It's 7-8 years since the war started, and for kid, it's whole memory.
Mm-hmm.
For us, it's difficult to remember how his life was before. So can you imagine for a little kid?
He doesn't know another life
anything.
Before. That's all he knows.
He doesn't know anything. He knows what his father wants him to know.
There's a scene, and I'm not giving too much away, where someone is very badly hurt in the film. And you don't show any violence, really, in the film.
No direct violence. No, I told you, it's enough from those footage that ISIS export about slighting, killing, burning, enough from those massacres and the blood and kids' pieces, and we saw enough of this. This is make people really get away from this crisis, from our crisis. You need to transfer the psychological part that's most dangerous, most horrible to the audience, to know what's inside mind, what's happened in the closing room, how it's the legacy of war transferred from generation to generation.
At what point did you know it was time to leave?
I try to finish my story, to have an end, a clear end, because I'm do this American way. This is how I learned cinema, like, mm-hmm. in a way. This is how you have the beginning, the body, and the end. So it was always in documentary, it's always difficult to make your end. And I always do an opening end, because always in my film you see someone in the track taking out the wrong direction, the direction that he should not take it from his, if you look at him from the first moment to the last moment. So he become a jihadist very early. He's still that boy. We see him play around, swimming, and do several things. He's still innocent, but they killed his innocent. They brainwash his thought, and he's ready to follow the fight against the enemy of God, which us. The first the Syrian and then all the world, because the first victims of those groups of terrorists is the Syrian themselves.
Mm-hmm. There are no women in the film, which is understandable. Did you try?
I tried.
You did, yes. Try?
Mm. Yeah. I tried, honestly, like many times, and this is the red line for them, like the woman appearance, that her voice is forbidden, called haram, like it's not allowed to be heard by any strangers. Strangers mean all of us except father, brothers, and husband and sons. So anyone except of those is not allowed to hear her voice. This is how they take the society. I don't know where it was happened like this before, but they do it right now, and is not and for sure if her voice is not be allowed, then her shape, like how her face should not be appear. So they are in a closing room, cooking, cleaning, or going as a group of women with all those burqok. Mm-hmm. They go to Sharia class, like to learn more about religion.
But you do include the
and
men
also
talking
look,
about
look,
the
look,
women.
I can tell you something honestly now. If you go also to those schools, not only in Syria and that part, you go to the schools they built in Turkey, the opposition, that it's a brother, Muslim Brotherhood, and they get support from some governments. They teach the same ideology about religion, about women, about people. Children become like a reward. They are really brainwashing in this. And we talk about Turkey is not like an area where it's have a civil war. It's like, so they try to build, to take the society really, really to the dark part. And this is what we fight as a moderate Syrian. We fight those conservative, those radical, not to steal the society for they have a power, they have money, and they do that.
I think one of the many chilling things in the film, I'm talking to Talal Derke about his film of Fathers and Sons. He returned to Syria and embedded as a filmmaker with some fighters, some people who consider themselves religious fighters with al-Nusra. One of the things that was very chilling was the main character and all the characters saying, we're just fighting until we win this. They said, this is the end of all wars. They believe
in this mythology. It's a kind of mythology, kind of all the stories, kind of something like outside of the reality, outside of the religion, outside of everything, that it's the last battle is coming, and everyone should prepare for it, and Armageddon, and there's the Antichrist will appear now, and we should and the Mahdi should appear, and they believe it, that it's like their own reality right now.
Were you ever frightened for your own safety? Did they ever suspect that you were not devout?
No, I mean, when I was there, if they suspect, then I will not be here with you now. There's no film to talk about, but I played like day by day, and to build this trust, and to show that I'm a good student for them. I'm there to learn, and I have the camera to show their power, and to show how society is strong, and how they prepare those kids for the upcoming caliphate. And so they're proud of what they are doing right now. They are really proud. They believe that this is the right, and this is how they prepare to fight the enemy of God, to fight the Shia, to fight. Everyone disagree with them until the black flag will cover the whole world. And this is called caliphate.
After spending so much time
with
them.
Yeah.
and I know you you disagree with everything about them. Do you understand why they feel this way?
It's like they are very like some people, they are maniac, they are hallucinate about some issue. I was teenager, I remember I was connected to heavy metal and death metal, and I was doing like anything to show myself from outside how that person. And this is also connected to their form, how they look like. You see, they left their beard, they shaved their mustache, they wore this Afghani galabi, and they have this sharp way of looking, and they show no mercy. So it's a type of people. They want an ideology that can, kind of ideologies that encourage violence, because they have this, the violence inside them. They take it from the childhood, mm-hmm. because in schools their teachers harming kids, in their house parents harming, they hitting kids with sticks, with their hands, everything. So the kids in Syria, in many areas, especially in the villages, they used to get harmed very bad from people who are more stronger. And this is when you grow up with this memory, with this things, because children are very sensitive. Sure. When they grow up, you want to export the violence, to give it to someone else. Now the circle is going around action and reaction. So this has happened to those society, plus the this old legacy of religion that encourage violence under the name of jihad. Mm-hmm. That this is said, it's in Quran, and this is thing that it's, I believe it's a time that for anyone who said that I am religion, to refuse and to reject the jihad, time to end up, to close this page from the history of a human.
How did you get started with filmmaking?
How I get, I through like my previous film, it's called Return to Homes, which won the big award, the Grand Jury Award of Sundance and other awards. It was on Netflix. I capture the civil war, like, and capture how the revolution become a civil war. Why? What's happened to the people? Why they carry? They decide to carry weapons, and how the city is destroyed and get siege and all of this. So, and I end up with the jihad in the end. Like, it's, you see the main character who was sacking in demonstration for freedom, singing a jihadi song in the end. So this is during that shooting, in the end I had the chance to meet some of those radical group and to spend time with them, and I find myself brave with them and do their everyday behaviors, and I understand I can do it.
Yeah.
And I said I have to do it now, because this is the most phenomenal, the worst phenomenon happened in the history of this country since the Islam came, like 1,400 years ago. Before it was 70% Christian, 30% they are different religions. So since that time, it wasn't it wasn't that much. They don't show savages as it's now.
The name of the film is Of Fathers and Sons. It's directed by Talal Derki. Talal, thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Thank you so much.
The Fathers and Sons is playing now at the Museum of Moving Image in Queens. Next on All of It, we'll talk to WNYC's dance critic Marina Haas about the various versions of the Nutcracker that New York City has to offer. Stay with us. Ah, Sugar Plum Fairies, it's that time of year when in New York City you can find multiple and varied productions of Tchaikovsky's The Nutcracker. How do you choose between New York City Ballet's version of The Nutcracker, or the hip-hop version, or the Bang Group's version called Nut/Cracked? To help us decide, we have with us in-studio dance critic for WNYC and The New Yorker, Marina Haas. Welcome, Marina.
Thank you, Allison.
So, just, I want an opinion question. Is The Nutcracker for little kids or for adults?
Well, different people would answer in different ways. I think, you know, it's definitely, it has, the theme is childhood. So, you know, take that as you will. I think Tchaikovsky thought of it as a sort of symphony of childhood. So the musical style and the setting of the piece is very much about the imagination of children. But there are some kind of dramatic undertones in the music and the story, so it can be taken in any direction, really.
So you really think it is a something that can be open to interpretation?
Absolutely, and all you have to do is look around and see how many different versions and how many different directions it's been taken in to see that really it's a sign of a great work that it can actually be taken as an open book.
Let's talk a little bit about Nutcracker Rouge. It mixes Nutcracker score with Vivaldi, Duke Ellington, Christina Aguilera, and Handel. What are the major themes of Nutcracker Rouge? This is...
Yes, well, that one's not for children.
That one's not for children. Okay, good to know.
You know, one of the themes of the Nutcracker always has been this theme of adventure and of this learning process for little Marie. What this company has done is that they've taken that theme and they've turned it into a theme of erotic awakening. And it's not really that far, actually, if you think about it.
Yeah.
It's an erotic education for a young woman. And they take it in a very cheeky direction with, they've got, you know, all sorts of burlesque and sort of S&M numbers and a lot of circus arts.
Are the costumes fabulous?
They're incredible. The designs are very Baroque inspired, very naughty, obviously, but they're actually really beautifully done. So it's not just smut. It's actually quite a well thought out production.
And so people can kind of have a sense of how that might get done. Nutcracker Rouge and the Bang Group's Nutcracked uses music from Duke Ellington's versions of Tchaikovsky's score. Let's take a listen. Oh, I'm picturing like red velvet banquettes and those little tea lights on the table.
The whole thing. And actually these, you know, very elaborate dresses and masks and things. I mean, that song just captures the sort of sophistication of both the Tchaikovsky and of the jazz interpretation of it.
Yeah, that arrangement's incredible.
Yeah.
So there's a hip-hop version of the Nutcracker.
Yes.
Is the music the same?
Well, there are elements. There are recorded elements. There's actually a live electric violin, which riffs on music from the Nutcracker, but there's also a DJ on stage mixing different types of hip hop, and the dancing is amazing because it's you've got popping and locking, you've got all these different kinds of hip hop dance, and you've got sort of these dance battles on stage. But it also has a really touching story that's set in New York, so it really has a lot of resonance for New Yorkers.
This is a clip of the production stage manager for the hip-hop version, Tracy Woolley, discussing it. Let's take a listen.
It's a tradition that every family has engaged in over the years at Christmas. And it's taken it into a different direction. And so to see this type of choreography done with this type of music, it tells me that dance is universal. You know, that you can take something that is from the street and put it in a classical upper echelon setting, and it still manages to create this beauty.
It's fun when you hear the record scratches come in there. And I imagine this opens it up to a whole group of people who never thought they'd care about the Nutcracker.
Yeah, and you know, the Nutcracker is about nostalgia in great part. And this really runs with that idea, but applies it to a very specific setting. So the Land of the Sweets is a 1980s club. And
that's so
the
cool
people that they see at the club, the kids see at the club, kind of look like their parents. And that's also an element of the Nutcracker, this feeling of remembering family Christmases past.
Marina Harz, dance critic for WNYC and The New Yorker, thank you for walking us through all things Nutcracker 2018 style.
Thank you so much.